During this hour of the show, we'll do something we do once a month on Focus 580, and that is talk about personal finance. Our guest, David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the University of Illinois. He has a wide-ranging background in financial management and advising on financial issues. And the show is an effort to get you answers to the questions that concern you the most. We'll talk in general about some issues with regard to money management, and then open the phone line. So if you'd like to join us, you are welcome to do so. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Also, toll-free anywhere you hear us. You can use our toll-free line if you're outside the 217 area code, 800-222-9455. And at any time during our conversation, feel free to give us a call. David Sinnoh, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jack. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. This morning, I would like to discuss two matters. The first matter concerns an often misunderstood and, frankly, rarely utilized retirement vehicle known as a single premium immediate annuity. And the lion's share of my remarks will be based upon quoted materials from Robert Hersey, Jr., a well-known business writer and commentator for the New York Times, and Mr. Hirsch Stern, an insurance broker and author of the financial periodical known as The Annuity Shopper. And the second item I'd like to discuss this morning is simply an update on our model portfolio. You recall that last month I would begin reporting each month on a year-to-date return of a 100% equity portfolio. So we'll go over that as well. Now, back to the first matter. Now, what if a top-rated insurance company, in return for a one-time premium payment, promised to send you, or both you and your spouse, a substantial check every month for the rest of your life or joint lives? It would probably come with a yield that was better than prevailing market interest rates, and as an option, retirees could guarantee that their initial payment was returned entirely either to them or their heirs. And there would be, well, no direct sales commission either. What's being offered and what I'm really talking about is a very specific kind of an annuity. Now, annuity is a term that covers a vast array of products that together have become, well, mired in popular perception as highly complex, expensive, and in the worst case, a good way to lose money. Much of this poor reputation, however, involves so-called deferred annuities. These are tax-advantaged vehicles intended for the gradual accumulation of assets, often involving mutual funds or involving stocks, and they're typically referred to as variable annuities. And if you're a good investor, well, you might succeed owning a variable annuity, but if you're not such a good investor, you can lose a substantial amount of money. And often when we track variable annuities, we find that they have very high expenses, very high loads to get out of, and very high commissions. So I haven't been very excited about those for a long period of time. But there is another version of annuity, and it's called an immediate annuity, that is not as well known and is designed to convert lump sum funds that you already have into a stream of payments that provide retirement income literally right away. In other words, almost the month after you retire. Now, although this type has been around long before today's variable annuities or other deferred annuities, it really only accounts for about 2.5% of the entire annuity market. Also, insurance agents, frankly, earn very little for selling or offering this type of immediate annuity, and it can be hard to persuade potential buyers to hand over a chunk of their life savings for an insurance contract, which is really not an investment that represents a wager that they will live longer than a giant insurance company thinks they will. However, there are some signs lately that immediate annuities are gaining popularity. One reason is the declining availability of traditional fixed corporate pensions. Those are disappearing. Another is that baby boomers, the oldest of whom turn 60 next year, are approaching retirement. Hard to believe, but our baby boomers are now approaching 60 years of age. Immediate annuities are really quite straightforward. You shop among insurance companies strong enough to make payments indefinitely and see which charges the least for a specified amount of income, say $1,000 a month. So you would shop 8 or 10 different insurance companies and say, look, I want a payment of $1,000 a month for the rest of my life, maybe for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, maybe for a joint and survivor term. And when you shop, you say, how much of a lump sum must I hand you today as a premium payment for that monthly guarantee of $1,000 a month, $1,200 a month, $1,500, you name the number. Now, as a rule of thumb, typically the cost for a 65-year-old individual these days is about 13 times the annual benefit. So whatever you want in terms of an annual benefit, multiply that times 13, and that would be sort of a example of how much money you would have to proffer to the insurance company up front. So a policy paying $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year for the typical 65-year-old would therefore cost somewhere around $150,000. And if you do the math, this works out to an annual interest rate of about 8%, which is, well, not quite double the current rate on a 10-year Treasury bond. I think a 10-year Treasury is about 4.2 today, but 8% isn't that bad. And not surprisingly, of course, the older you are, the less you pay. In fact, some financial advisors advise waiting a few years after retiring to buy an immediate annuity to get really a firmer grip on your overall financial situation. You can also prevent the insurance company from reaping a windfall if you suddenly die. For example, if you buy a policy that says, hey, pay me as long as I'm living, and then 3 months later, the mad bicyclist runs you over while you're minding your own business in the crosswalk, well, the insurance company would keep your money. So for an additional amount of money for sort of a premium rider, you can have a period certain annuity so that the beneficiary or your heirs collects for the balance of a term, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, even 20 years or more. And another option, of course, would return to your beneficiary the remainder of the money originally paid in the event of your untimely death. So single premium immediate annuities, and for short they're called SPIA, are purchased really with a single deposit and usually commence regular income payments 1 month after you make the deposit. So they make sense for retirement. An immediate annuity, of course, as I said, can be purchased with funds from a variety of sources, perhaps a CD, perhaps some other type of investment, maybe even an inheritance, who knows. And the key element to understand with an immediate annuity is the nature of the exchange that simply takes place between you and the insurance company. In return for this one-time lump sum payment, the insurance company agrees to pay you an income stream. And typically, even after you buy it and you receive the contract, if you have buyer's remorse, there is always a free look period when you read the contract, so that you can say, you know, I've made a mistake. I don't really think this meets my goals or objectives. Hand me back my money. So you can exercise what's called a typical free look period, usually around 30 days as a matter of contract. I think there are a number of advantages for this vehicle. First of all, it's simple. The annuitant, or you, the recipient of these funds, doesn't have to manage the investment, watch the markets, report interest rates or dividends, or compete against other investment professionals. There is security. The annuity provides you a lifetime income benefit. Typically, the returns that you will earn on your annuity are higher than current interest rates or CD rates. And I think this is going to be even a more interesting investment, a more interesting annuity contract, if we continue to see rises in short-term interest rates in the economy. And Alan Greenspan certainly hasn't suggested anything to the contrary, as we could see those interest rates increasing. Thus, the insurance company should be willing to pay out a little bit more monthly based upon these higher interest rates. Safety of principle, well, if you choose a AAA insurance company, your job is to choose an insurance company that is going to outlive you. That's your job when you own life insurance, you own an annuity product. You want to make certain that your insurance company is around long after you and your beneficiaries have met your maker. Also, something to keep in mind, favorable tax treatment. Often, your premium is paid with after-tax dollars. Thus, most of your monthly annuity payment from the insurance company is returned to you on a tax-free basis. So if you were receiving that $1,000 a month, it's entirely possible $800 to $900 of it could be tax-free. And the rest, of course, would be imputed interest. Finally, you can now purchase an immediate annuity, which is adjusted for inflation. Isn't that interesting? Naturally, it's more expensive, but each year there can be a insurance inflation rider on that amount. So if it started out with $1,000, maybe a year from now it's $1,040 or whatever. So we have that proviso as well. Now, like any investment, be certain to rigorously investigate it and discuss its application to your situation with your financial advisor. So don't jump too quickly. Don't leap. Make certain that you get some sound advice on whether this really makes sense for you. But it's certainly something that is not in the mainstream, and it's something our listeners should be aware of. Okay, why don't we turn for a moment to our model portfolio? You'll recall that our model portfolio is really a 100% equity portfolio. And for simplification purposes, we used Vanguard Asset Class Funds. I sort of call it the David Sino Recipe Portfolio. I invest a good deal of my own money in this portfolio. And more importantly, as I mentioned last month, I invest my wife's money in this portfolio. And that's even a worse thing if you would lose any money for your wonderful wife. And she truly is a wonderful lady, Carol. Well, let me tell you again, just to review what that portfolio consisted of. It was 10% of your money in the Index 500, 15% in the U.S. Value Index, 10% in U.S. Small Cap, 15% in U.S. Small Cap Value, 10% in the Mid Caps, the S&P really 400, the REIT Index, that's real estate, it's been on fire. 10% of the money in real estate, 20% in the total international index, and 10% in the emerging markets around the world. Year to date, how have we done? Well, year to date, including dividends, through yesterday's close, that portfolio is up 5.24% for the year. Now, what might we use as a proxy? What might we use as a benchmark for comparison purposes? And I think probably the total stock market index would be a good index to use. Some people call it the Wilshire 5000, but basically it's a market-weighted index of all of the U.S. stock market. And if we looked at that particular index for the year, that index is up about 2.3% for the year. So we're doing a good deal better than the total international, than the total market index. So I'm very, very pleased about that. And again, if we just simply looked at the S&P 500, that's up about 1.7% for the year, including its dividends. So we're doing significantly better, about three times better than that. So the lesson is diversification. You don't expect all of these asset classes to move in the same direction. But clearly, by having diversification, if you're going to be in a 100% equity portfolio, it's important to be well diversified. So there you have it, Jack, a little bit about a financial planning technique known as annuities, whether it fits or whether it doesn't fit, and a little bit of an update on our 100% equity portfolio. So I would be delighted to answer any questions on these topics I've discussed this morning or other financial topics on our listeners' minds.
Well, very good. David Sino, professor of finance at the University of Illinois. He's with us this morning to take your questions on personal finance. You can either follow up on the topics that he just discussed, or if you'd like to ask something completely different, you're welcome to do that as well. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us. 800-222-9455. While we wait for people to join us on the phone lines, just a quick follow-up on the single premium immediate annuity.
Yes.
A lot of syllables in that, but anyway, so this sounds like the return of about 8% is what you're, you know, sort of as a ballpark figure.
Well, it's a little bit misleading because what really happens is you're almost, it's like a mortgage. You're getting an amortized payment. And the bottom line is that the imputed interest rate is more in the 5% area. But if you take this lump sum and you had to reinvest it to procure that kind of monthly income, you'd be looking at 8%. So it's a little bit of a misnomer, but if we do the imputed interest on it, it's still a little bit higher than CDs. It is a monthly guarantee, et cetera. So I don't want to mislead anyone about the actual rate of return that you're earning on the product. It's if you would have to generate $1,000 a month, you would have to earn 8%, in other words. But the insurance company is not paying you 8% because a good portion of it is a return of principal as well. But still makes some sense for some retirees.
I understand. So, you know, in terms of the real impact, like you say, if you were to take that and invest it in terms of the return that you get on a monthly basis, the, you know, sort of a virtual return.
Exactly.
Of 8%.
Exactly.
So this would fit in perhaps a strategy that would also, you know, encompass investing in, you know, mutual funds,
absolutely,
stock market, and so forth.
Absolutely. It's one piece of an overall retirement pie. And some people would like to have a known amount of income coming in each month. Now, keep in mind that it is not adjusted for inflation. So when one looks at this kind of annuity, one also needs to look at whether or not that annuity should be adjusted for inflation.
Okay. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll get on to our first listener joining us on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
I have a question about market performance in the period from 1975 to 80 when we had rampant or increasing inflation. And do you know what market sectors may have been good performers in that time period? Because I'm wondering if we may be headed to a parallel situation now with high energy prices.
Well, I don't have that at the tip of my fingers, but let's think about it, because you're absolutely right. In the late 70s, we had rampant inflation and we had extraordinarily high interest rates. People were borrowing money at 19, 20, 21, even 22%. So the best investment in those periods of time, if you had an escalating interest rate, was to pay yourself. As I recall, I think precious metals, the natural resources, commodities did extremely well. But also, I think if you go back and look at stocks in general, that they had a pretty good run during that period of time as well. This was after the 72-73 bear market and before the 87 sort of market crash that people realize. So it really was a decent time for stocks. It was a great time if you had cash. If you had cash, you were able to purchase these wonderful and magnificent treasury instruments guaranteed by the U.S. government, paying these exorbitant interest rates. I remember 14, 15, 16% money market rates, 12 and 13%, but we had tremendous inflation as well. So if you believe that we're going to head back into a very high inflationary period, and I wanted to touch on that just for a moment this morning, then I think you're looking at some of the hard assets, precious metals, and then also you're probably not going to see a back off on real estate, because real estate has always done well in high inflation periods of time.
And do you think we're headed to higher inflation?
Well, I think we're already seeing higher inflation. There's no question about it. In fact, looking at the Consumer Price Index, and that's probably a low estimate because it's a Department of Labor figure, and a lot of people argue that really it's based upon numbers that make the index artificially low. We're up 3.2% just in consumer price retail inflation from a year ago, and just this week, retail inflation was up 0.5% from last month, and more importantly, the Producer Price Index, which is the inflationary rate at the wholesale level, was up more than 1%. Now, naturally, energy is having this dramatic impact. But I really wonder how much energy prices are going to drop. I'm not certain, and I'm not a prognosticator, but I do know that we have two countries on Earth that have a voracious appetite for energy. That's the United States, and that's China. And China is under a very difficult catch-22 situation because they have this enormous population that is in need of jobs. in order to sort of really keep the economic lid on and the economic engine growing, they've got to employ literally hundreds of thousands of people monthly, just monthly, to keep up with that demand. So they're going to artificially keep their prices low, and they're going to utilize tremendous amounts of energy, whether it is iron ore from the iron country of Minnesota or whether it is oil from all over the world. So I am concerned that we're not going to go back, at least shortly, to $30, $35 a barrel oil. I just don't see it in the short run. So I think if we're going to see that oil stay very high in the 60s, in the 50s, whatever, that's got to bring higher prices. We've got to pass that on to the consumer. And especially in our economy, where we're doing reasonably well, it's going to be easier for wholesalers, it seems to me, to pass on those increases. So we are going to see more inflation than we've been used to. That would be my view of it. Now, a lot of people could disagree. Maybe oil is going to go back to $30 a barrel, et cetera. But as long as we are so dependent on the usage of oil for our energy, we're going to have continued inflation. We're also having Alan Greenspan, who is showing no stoppage, shall we say. He's not being stopped in raising the Fed funds rate. So we're seeing that translated into higher interest rates in our economy. So, yes, I sort of share your notion that we're going to see more inflation. I don't think we're going to see hyperinflation, but we're going to certainly see more inflation than we've been used to over the last 5 to 7 years.
Yeah, and then what does that do to the stock market?
That's a tough call. That's a tough call. What's really interesting about the stock market is the portfolio I've been discussing this morning is up over 5% in spite of the fact that oil has literally doubled. Gasoline has literally doubled in many places in the country over the last 12 months. What that suggests to me is a tremendous resiliency of the U.S. stock market. So if oil turned around and dropped $20 a barrel, I'm not suggesting it will, I just don't simply know, then we might be headed for higher prices in the U.S. stock market. But I'm not a prognosticator of the stock market. That's why, as I've said in the past and other programs, I'm more of a legacy investor. I've got to be invested for the very long term so I can deal with these ups and these downs and these barrels of oil at 60 and 50 and 40. Because in the long run, if I am well diversified and I have some of my money in equities, I know that over long, long periods of time, that's likely to outperform most other investments. Now, Scott Burns, who is a commentator extraordinarily well thought of, said that one of the asset classes that should be added to a portfolio today is an energy asset class, that it really is now becoming a separate asset class. And we need to look at sources of energy, whether it is raw materials, whether it is the oil companies, et cetera, that is in effect, in his view, becoming a separate asset class. So if you are concerned about inflation, you might consider adding to your portfolio, if you do not have it at the current time, that type of asset class, turning to energy companies.
Is he talking about energy producers like an oil company or including the utilities that are converting to and delivering electricity?
Not so much the utilities, but more of the producers and the distributors, but okay. Not specifically the utilities.
Right. Well, thank you.
Okay. My pleasure. Great question.
Thanks so much for the call. We're a little past our midpoint here with David Sino, professor of finance at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, here taking your questions on personal finance. We have one listener waiting patiently. We'll get right to, and plenty of time for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Caller on Des Plaines on line number 4. Good morning.
Oh, yes. Good morning, David. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a question on your opinion concerning, I've got a small amount of mortgage on my home, and I was thinking about paying it off and then applying for a reverse mortgage, using the funds from the reverse mortgage to get a summer place in Northwest Michigan. And I was wondering if, with your background, you might be able to comment on that as a strategy of how to handle that.
Well, let me ask you some basic questions. Number one, what is your interest rate on your current mortgage?
Like 5 1/8.
5 1/8, a handsome rate indeed.
Yeah.
And are you itemizing on your tax return?
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay. So if you're itemizing on your tax return, your effective interest rate on that mortgage is probably about 3.5.
Oh, I see how you did that. Okay.
All right. So you take your tax bracket, because you are itemizing on your return, multiply that 1 minus your tax rate times your mortgage rate, and that will give you your effective interest rate. That's really what you're paying. So the federal government, because you are itemizing, is subsidizing you, just like myself, on a mortgage.
Yeah.
So your effective rate is 3.5%. And now we have to look at what a reverse mortgage, that effective interest rate. Have you done some research on reverse mortgages?
I've gotten some materials about the concept of reverse mortgages. But no sit-down, no discussion of what rates would be from the reversal. This would be an alternate of taking other funds and getting a summer home in Northwest Michigan.
I like the idea of a summer home in Northwest Michigan.
Oh, okay.
I like that idea because I think that's an area of the country that has done very well and will continue to do well.
I see.
So in terms of making an investment in that area of the country, I don't have a problem with that if you're in a position to do that.
Okay.
Now, with a reverse mortgage, you need to understand that you can borrow more money in a reverse mortgage the older you are.
Mm-hmm.
The younger you are, the less money that you typically can borrow in a reverse mortgage, because it makes sense, because typically these things aren't paid off while one is living. It's usually paid off when one passes away. So you sound relatively young, and you probably have a long life expectancy, so you may even be able to borrow less money than you think with this reverse mortgage. Pretty young. That's pretty young on a reverse mortgage, yeah. But you can go to a number of websites. In fact, if you're at a computer and you Google in reverse mortgage, there are a number of websites that will come up, and there are calculators on those websites that would basically ask, you know, what is your house worth? What is your age? And that will give you an idea of the lump sum that you can borrow along with a payment schedule.
I see.
All right? So that would give you some idea. Frankly, I'm not enamored with it. I'm usually more enamored with a reverse mortgage for someone who is looking for income for retirement, as opposed to taking money out of an asset and then reinvesting it somewhere else.
I see.
So I'm not real crazy about the idea for this particular purpose. On the other hand, I like the idea of a second home in Michigan if you are truly going to utilize it and have investigated the area of the country, and that would make some sense.
I see.
So bottom line is, I like your 3.5% effective rate on your current mortgage, because very frankly, that's a pretty cheap rate.
That's
a pretty cheap rate. And if you're way, way down on the amortization schedule already, most of what you're hammering down every month when you make that mortgage payment is principal anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult for me to think of you paying that off.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather have you not pay that off, probably utilize some other assets, and basically then utilize that for a down payment or whatever on your second home.
And could you, David, I'm a slow writer, but the various investment, I guess that's no-brainer program.
Portfolio?
Yes.
Well, those were Vanguard family of mutual funds.
And I need a repeat of that, if you don't mind.
Okay.
I'm a slow writer.
Sure, that's okay. The S&P 500, which is known as the Index 500, I had 10% of my money invested in that.
Okay.
At Vanguard, that's fund number 40.
Okay.
U.S. Value. 15%.
15, okay.
That's fund number 06.
Okay.
U.S. Small Cap, 10%.
Okay.
Fund 48. Small Cap Value, U.S. Small Cap Value, 15%.
Okay.
That's fund number 860.
All right.
U.S. Mid Cap, those are the mid cap stocks, U.S. market, 10%.
10%.
Fund number 859. The REIT index, that's the real estate index. Now, if you're already heavy in real estate, you might not need to have that as index.
Okay. 10%.
All right. Fund number 123. Total international index, 20%. Fund number 113. And the emerging markets index, 10%, which is number 533. And as I always tell people, I don't have any financial interest in Vanguard. I don't make any money by recommending them. It's just an easy proxy to use. There are certainly other mutual fund companies that have similar indexes, and Vanguard happens to be one of the lower cost providers. So I utilize that as a proxy.
So this would be someone who, as you say, may have many years to come, hopefully.
Yes, absolutely.
Going forward, not necessarily someone below 50 where this would be more appropriate. I mean, it's not age in any way related then, right?
No, that's my opinion because always look at being a legacy investor, and this is for someone who is willing to stay in the stock market a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully believe that whether one is 50, 60, 70, a portion of their assets really need to be in equities in order to keep up with inflation, but it has to be a comfortable level. Whether it's 20% of the assets or 50% of the assets, that's more of a personal decision. But with those assets, a portion being in a well-diversified portfolio of equities.
Wonderful. All right. As always, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Thank you for the call. Several callers waiting. We'll go next to a Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah. My question also goes to the fund, the portfolio you just described. Unless I'm missing something, it's going to take a lot of money to establish, the initial portfolio because, as I understand it, Vanguard, like most of these index funds, have minimums for initial investment. So what would be the minimum amount of money that it would require to initially establish this 100% equity diversified portfolio you're talking about?
Well, number one, Vanguard has two rules. If you decide to invest your money through a Roth IRA, the minimum investment per fund is $1,000. If you are taking after-tax money and not through a retirement plan, then the minimum investment is $3,000. So someone, for example, in the year 2005 and 2006 who is investing through a Roth IRA could really put all of these funds together into a Roth IRA program. And otherwise, it would take about $24,000. Does that answer your question?
Well, I guess I don't There are eight different funds there.
That's correct.
Okay.
Eight different funds. So if you invested $1,000 in four of those funds in 2005 through your Roth IRA, and we're almost to the end of 2005,
right.
And the minute you're in 2006, you take another $4,000 and buy the other funds, you now have essentially established those eight funds with $8,000.
Okay, but you couldn't do the 15-20% at that and get the $24,000 minimum?
No, you would have to first establish the funds with a $1,000 minimum.
And build it up over
And then time. Build it up from there. Sure.
Oh, okay. That clarifies something for me.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Several callers. We'll go next to another Champaign Urbana listener, line number three. Good morning.
Hi. Interesting comment on the HMO situation. Like the news says, some people see a steady 7%. Which is nice if you can get it in investments, but the premiums are going up in double digits, and the policy doesn't cover everything, so the costs of the supplies are going up at double digits, and some people go over the border to buy the supplies, and it pays for the total trip. They get a vacation and cheaper supplies.
I think we lost the caller. Not sure exactly what happened there.
I'm not sure either. Maybe the caller was on a cellular or something. I think the caller was talking about the fact that medical expenses are going up faster than the overall inflation rate. So it is true. We have what's called the flight across the border. Although I see in Canada, Canada is trying to really put a stop to that.
Mm-hmm.
They have really worked on that. And I think some people on your programs have even talked about that as well. So it is true that, unfortunately, medical expenses and medical costs are still moving up much more quickly than the overall inflation rate.
Well, that's another subject, and maybe we can come back to that, but we have another listener waiting, and we'll go on to them. Let me just mention the phone numbers again. We're talking with David Sino, professor of finance at the University of Illinois, taking your questions on personal finance. We raised a number of issues and happy to talk about others. Around Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Urbana listener next on line number two. Good morning.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
I've been listening to you for years, and I know you talk about legacy investments and stuff like that. This is more of a philosophical point. I remember John Maynard Keynes was asked about long-term investment, and I think he said something to the effect, in the long term, we're all dead. But I'm sort of wondering if within the mathematics of the supposed science of economics, is there any sort of variable for, like, environmental damage other than the loss of woods after a fire or something like that? Because I think, and I'm sort of looking at this from a, like, an environmental perspective, where you have 6 billion people, you have all these economies growing, and where is the variable for, taking it out of the anthropocentric view, where's the variable for, like, when will the environment, you know, so much of this economic activity damage the environment irreparably? I mean, is there anything like that in the equations or anything like that, or is it purely an anthropocentric thing where it's all affects, obviously just affects us because it's sort of our subject anyway? I mean, we created this whole modern economies and stuff like that. But I'm just wondering if you ever think about that, or if anybody works in that, because I've never read anything like that.
I think there are probably a number of economists who do work on it, as a matter of fact. I'm trying to think back to my basic economics 101 and 102, and I need a professor of economics to call in because there's a term for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking disutility, but I know that isn't exactly the term, but we're on the same page there, where there has to be factored in to the profit motive, the extraneous disutility costs that are impacted. And there is a wide breadth of literature that has been written on this. Now, how that impacts the stock market, I have not seen any literature on that. And that is a great area and probably a fertile area of research.
Yeah. I think, also, another point. Earlier this year, Greenspan was quoted as saying, I don't know, I'm getting philosophical here, but as he was had made a speech, it wasn't before Congress, it was one of these, you know, places he goes to, and he said something that in reference to, I think it was something to do with the estate taxes, he said, well, in the long run, everyone's bankrupt, assuming you draw down, you send your money off to the, you know, as an estate, then it goes to the relatives, and then the eighth or ninth generation down, they've blown it all. And I just don't know I don't know if you'd heard that or not, or what you thought of that. But thank you very much. I appreciate the information. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, as far as the estate taxes, currently, for anyone who passes away and leaves an estate of $1.5 million of assets or less, there are no estate taxes. The next dollar, however, gets taxed at 47 cents on the dollar. So it's hard to believe that it is a very, very substantial tax burden among wealthier taxpayers in the United States. And of course, the amount of exemption goes up each year until the year 2000, and I believe 11. As a matter of fact, I believe in the year 2011, our exemption amount drops back, as I recall, to something like $1 million. But between now and then, the exemption amount really jumps to as high as $3.5 million. And in fact, next year, someone who leaves an estate of $2 million would not pay any federal estate taxes. But yes, I guess you're right. In the very last analysis, when we're not here, I guess we can't take it with us. So we either leave it to some charitable cause or to a relative. Now, I hope that the relatives or friends don't blow it, as our listener suggested. But unquestionably, when the estate tax was set up, it was set up as part of a redistribution of wealth in society. No question about it. It was an attempt to take wealth, tax it, bring it into the government coffers, and then redistribute it. So it was a process of redistribution.
The 2011 figure you mentioned, dropping down to 1 million, obviously we're not going to place wagers on the actions of Congress, but one might be forgiven for betting that they're going to up that or change
it. No question about it. As a matter of fact, in 2010, a state tax is repealed.
Yeah.
So under current law. So something is going to happen probably before 2010, because otherwise people who pass away in 2010, it's not good to pass away, but I guess the estate taxes would be repealed, so there would be no estate taxes for that particular estate. In 2009, the exemption amount is $3.5 million. There's a lot of talk, Jack, as you know, yeah, to keep that number at about $3.5 million, and that covers 99% of America.
Very good. We have another listener waiting, and just about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Time for others if you'd like to join us real quick. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Urbana listener next on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I wondered what you did with the portion of your funds that were not equities but were in fixed, because you revealed what you know your model portfolio for the equity portion. What about the other portion?
That's a great question. And basically what I do with the other portion is to do bond laddering. I'm a great believer in simplicity, so I maintain a bond ladder with a current maturity of that bond ladder of 3.5 years. So
right,
essentially what I've done is take a portion of my money and put it in a 6-month bond, a 12-month, 18, 24, 30, and 36 and 42. So it's an equal amount in each one, 1/7 essentially in each of those instruments. However, that bond ladder may consist of T-notes, it may consist of certificates of deposit, or it may even in some instances consist of municipal bonds, depending upon the quality of the municipal bond and the interest rate it pays. And I was going to spend a little bit of time and talk about bond ladders, because as Alan Greenspan continues to push interest rates up, well, long-term interest rates have not moved very much, and short-term are starting to move up a little bit. You're looking at over 4% on the 5-year Treasury now. So there are some opportunities in bond laddering. But as far as buying complicated bond instruments, I'm really not into that. Now, some of my clients are into buying dividend-paying stocks as an alternative, or looking at a dividend-paying mutual fund. So
right,
those are possibilities as well. But I keep it pretty vanilla, pretty simple,
right,
100% equity portfolio, and then simply a bond ladder. I'm not trying to outperform the market.
Right.
I just simply want to earn the interest rates cleanly and gently and simply that the interest market is willing to give me.
Right. And do you decide between the T-note CDs and municipal bonds based on their relative advantage when you're ready to reinvest?
Absolutely. So when I'm ready to reinvest, I simply turn on the computer. I'll look at national CD rates. I have no problem in buying a certificate of deposit across the internet, believe me. And those CD rates are significantly higher often than Treasury instrument rates. And often when you do have a CD rate that you can put money into across an internet site with a FDIC-insured bank, sometimes you can go back to your local bank and they will come very, very close to matching that CD rate for you.
Oh, I see. That's pretty good. The advantage of municipal bonds for someone like yourself who's in a high tax bracket, you still figure these other instruments. You still calculate them each time.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then
you've got to look at your relative income tax bracket, and you've got to look at that spread, because the spreads are always moving between Treasuries, for example, and munis. So
I
that
see.
Spread contracts and it expands, so you just simply don't know on any given day.
How do you know how to select the munis?
How do you select them? You've got to buy general obligation munis. You have to buy GOs.
Right.
No longer can you buy and afford to buy revenue bonds. You've got to buy general obligation bonds that are backed by full faith and credit of either the state taxing authority or a real estate taxing authority. Those are the only bonds that I will buy anymore as municipal bonds.
I see. And you trust each state in that, basically.
I do. I think it would be political suicide if one of these states defaulted.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine it.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much, David.
My pleasure.
Good.
Thanks for the call. Another caller waiting patiently on line number 4 in Indiana. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Two things. The preface is that the question I'm going to ask, the assumption to ask it may be wrong or needs to be changed a little bit, but I was talking with some old fellows from school who hadn't seen in a long time, and of course things went very quickly to the oil situation, and most of them were concerned about the transparency of the oil situation. And I thought perhaps you, since you, the beginning of the program, you make rather general statements about the economy. And they, of course, mentioned Exxon and, I guess, all the things it did back in the 70s, the 80s to, I guess, milk the American public. And I just wondered, from your perspective, are you have any concerns at all about the transparency of the oil, in the, you know, from the full gamut of pulling it out of the ground to getting it to the refinery, then eventually to the service station? We hear a lot about we just don't have the refining capacity, and that's where they were attacking that, that that may have been a rather interesting ploy on the oil companies to make sure that, the, in a sense, the amount available would be squeezed so that the profits would increase that way. Any comments at all about that?
Well, there's always a question about good corporate citizenship and questionable corporate citizenship, and I just simply don't have the answers to that. You hope that corporations are good corporate citizens. Clearly, at the same time, corporations are in the business of maximizing profits. So I presume that if you put the squeeze on refinery capacity, that you're ultimately going to increase the price of gasoline. And a lot of people, a lot of Congress people are arguing that that's really what's occurred.
Yeah.
But I'm not willing to sit here because I simply am not an insider, don't have enough information to suggest it. But it certainly has been bandied about, hasn't it?
Yes. And I guess the second thing was is, I remember that period, but not a lot because I was more or less hitting the books pretty much, and I didn't have to rely on gasoline because, you know, just walk across the campus, that sort of thing. But were there any signs that showed up where people, you know, who have a better understanding of the oil business saw these things and started thinking, just like these congressmen are thinking now about the lack of refineries in the United States? Is there anything on the horizon that one would you could point to or anything like that that would give it a signal?
You know, I really am just not cognizant and have enough information, but I think those are wonderful questions. You're asking what are the leading indicators?
Yeah.
And certainly someone has done some research in that area, but I frankly haven't. What I do recall is when that oil was so cheap and gasoline was so cheap that everyone was selling off their refinery equipment and their drilling equipment for, what, a nickel on the dollar, 10 cents on the dollar. And some pretty intelligent people must have bought that up and just sort of, what, warehoused it and then brought it out again when prices skyrocketed.
Okay, then the second thing is I've heard this for years now, that when gas goes up, natural gas goes up. I'm wondering what all the connections are there. Yesterday, out of Chicago, they were said that as of July 1st, natural gas went up at least 33 1/3%, basically $6 and something per whatever the unit is they use in BTUs, and up to $9 and something. And these guys said, "Well, yeah, that always happens. Nobody knows why." Blah blah. I was wondering if you have any perspective on that, and I'll hang up. And thanks a lot for another good show.
Well, I really don't have a good perspective on it, so I better not offer one. But that's an interesting question, also. Yeah. And I think this whole area is another WILL discussion, Jack.
I was thinking the same thing. I think we need to do more on what's going on with the energy sector, and we certainly can follow up and do that. So we have a caller waiting. We have just about 2 minutes left, so we'll have to be quick about this. So listener in Champaign, line number one. Good morning.
Hi. I just had a question about your opinion on how to finance a finishing our basement. And we're basically, we've got about 2 years left on a home equity that we use to for the down payment. We've got about 2 years left to pay that off, and we've got the first mortgage is 15-year that we refinanced a couple of years ago, and so we've got it down to about 5.25%.
That's a great rate.
Yeah, and so what? But of course, with this equity loan, we're using that part to we itemize, and so we get that mortgage off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be gone in 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if we what typically do people do when they finish their basement? Can they get another home equity loan?
Well, I think a home equity loan typically gives you a range of dollars that you can utilize against that home. So you probably have not utilized all of the dollars on your home equity loan. In other words, it's usually a line of credit. Have you tapped out all of the money on your home equity line?
Well, no, we use that initially as part of our down payment.
Oh, as part of your down payment.
Right.
I see.
Okay. What I mean, we've basically paid off quite a bit of that. So we only have 2 years left of that original.
Are you in the process of already finishing your basement?
No.
All right. So you're going to wait until you have the home equity line paid off.
Well, sure. That was the thing, because we're thinking that if rates go up,
okay,
then that might affect us.
Here's my reaction. Number one, do not refinance your first.
Okay. Yeah,
don't refinance your first. That 5.25% is a wonderful rate. And number two, go back to your current lender and see if what they would do for you by increasing your line on your second, on your home equity line, which would allow you to then finish your basement, presuming that you can afford to do that.
Okay, so then that would be...
that would be your best choice.
The line of credit they
right.
have there.
That would be your best choice.
Okay, great. All right, well, thanks.
All right, thank you. We're out of time, so we're going to have to stop. Let me just say again, though, that our guest has been David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He joins us once a month on the third Friday at 10 o'clock to take your questions on personal finance. As always, it's a great pleasure to have you here, David.
Jack, thanks so much, and what just tremendous questions our listeners ask.
Always.